Good morning, diners and travelers. You're once again listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Still with Ann and Peter Haig. Huh?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
I want to say a very special good morning.
Yes.
To our Irish listeners. I'm sure we have some new Irish listeners who've joined on since On the Menu started to cover your wonderful country. And we're finishing up our coverage of our recent trip to the Emerald Isle with two fascinating characters.
When I
tell you that one of them established his restaurant, in fact, well, I guess his parents helped him establish it more than 40 years ago, and he and his wife have worked there together for 30 years. And then the first up in the program, the guinea pig, has been operating as a restaurant since 1957, I think, or something like that.
Is that the one where I wanted Bono to come?
Yeah, and Mervyn Stewart, the owner, has been running it since 1977. And I don't know whether Eric Clapton goes there or not, but plenty of other famous people do, including Bono.
Yeah,
because Bono actually lives in the beautiful little town of Dorky, which we discovered all too late.
Yeah,
because
it was
due for dinner. It's a really charming place, and only about 20 minutes on the train or by car from the capital city of Dublin, from the center of Dublin, for that matter.
You know, I tweeted Bono saying, why weren't you there?
And did he reply?
No.
He didn't get back to you?
He didn't get back to me.
I'm sure it's only because he's busy.
I think so.
Because he's very polite, like all the Irish. He's very polite and welcoming and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, first up, at the guinea pig in Dorky, chef owner Mervyn Stewart.
Listeners, listen in now because we're going to have some fun here. We're talking to Mervyn Stewart with an EW, right, Mervyn?
EWART.
Okay. And he has a very colorful background and a wonderful establishment, a lot of fun, called the Guinea Pig Seafood
Restaurant.
Restaurant.
Dalkey, County Dublin.
Okay, spelled D-A-L-K.
K-E-Y.
Mervyn, let's just start at the beginning and say that this actual business and building, it's been here for how many years?
The restaurant was opened up originally in 1957.
And it was a restaurant at that time.
It always has been since.
Yeah. You and your wife bought it then in 1977.
That's correct.
And you've run it continuously since then.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and it's something of a landmark, right?
Well, they call it an institution.
Okay, well that's...
And I feel institutionalized. But I'm very lucky. I still enjoy my cooking, and people seem to like what we do, so we continue working.
Now, do you cook, actually?
Yeah, I've been cooking since I was 14 years of age.
Tell us, because that's sort of colorful, too. Tell us a little bit about this background, because it gives us a little sense of the social and economic history of Ireland as well.
I left school at the age of 12 and a half. And I had a scholarship into St. Patrick's Cathedral Choir and School in Dublin. I was a boy soprano. I had a medal from the Royal School of Church Music in London. And I was meant to go on to Trinity College to become a minister. Because I was a member of a big, large family who were very poor, the money was never going to be there to do that. So
you were seven children.
One of seven children.
You're second to the eldest.
That's correct.
And you're Protestant?
Church of Ireland.
That's Protestant, right?
That is Protestant, yes.
Yeah, because my most favorite, best neighbor, was actually a Protestant from Dublin, who she was my neighbor for years in Philadelphia. Absolutely adored her. So she had wonderful, colorful stories, too.
Well, growing up as a young boy in the country area, we never really had problem being Church of Ireland in a 99% Catholic country. But we were always living in a very conservative atmosphere, what my parents would call a very Christian conservative atmosphere, and that's carried through with me all my life. But we were talking about schooling and what happened. There were two ladies in my life that had a huge influence. One was my mother, who was an incredibly good teacher, and the other lady was the wife of the Archdeacon of Kildare, Mrs. Handy, and she knew the owner of a big hotel in Dublin called the Royal Hibernian Hotel, and she arranged with the owner that I would be indentured there for 5 years to become a chef.
Apprenticed might be
apprenticed
better.
Well, the word was indentured. It was like slavery in those days. And she always felt that if you learned to trade in Ireland, you would have a job. And that's what she wanted me to do. And the rest is history.
Wow. So you worked there, you said you trained under, which is not surprising at the time, a classical French chef.
Yeah, what happened was after the Second World War, the big hotels in Ireland brought over Swiss, German and French chefs to teach the Irish how to cook. If you think back to the early 50s, there was still rationing all over Europe, and Ireland had no rationing. We had all the food in the world that you could eat, and wealthy people flew in, took boats into Ireland to eat, just like they fly to New Orleans today, and Dublin was the Mecca. But these French, German and Swiss chefs were amazing guys, and they really brought the cuisine in Ireland up to a very, very high level.
So you really are technically well-trained.
I would say classically well-trained.
Yeah, but I mean in technique. But you have all these, every chef we've interviewed since we've been in Ireland just goes on about how gorgeous the product is that you have access to, and you showed it to us en route in with your 5-pound lobster that was glistening and gorgeous.
We're very fortunate that we have the green and pleasant land, which it is. We have the best of fish, the best of vegetables, fruit in season, whatever. And it's up to the chef then to make use of that as he sees fit. Traditionally, in our restaurant, we have never got involved with nouvelle cuisine, modern cuisine, any fusion cuisine. We know here, our customers come here for a certain reason, simply cooked fresh fish and good basic produce. And that's why they keep coming back to us year after year.
You're talking to a fan already. Can't wait. Let's talk a little bit about how your menu is organized. What are your hours to start with? When are you open?
Well, we open at night time only, from 5:30 on until late, seven nights a week. And we specialize in mostly fish, but we also have chicken, duck, lamb and steak, which is quite popular as well. But you have to offer an alternative to fish. But fish is the big thing here. We'd have 11 different fish on the menu every night.
Where do you get them? I mean, you probably have good relationships with
purveyors. Well, we would have our suppliers, but the crabs and lobsters come from the local harbour. The flatfish all comes from the west coast. The Irish Sea is fished out, and nobody buys fish from the Irish Sea anymore, but it all comes from the west coast.
Well, now, are you caught up in the whole issue of sustainability has hit chefs all across I know, in more countries than the U.S., including the big conference in Paris.
Are we talking here about wild fish in particular?
Yeah.
Well, my own view is that what's going to happen in the next 10, 15 years is that there'll be two grades of fish. You will pay a certain price for farmed fish, and you'll pay a premium for wild fish. And that way, you've got sustainability, and you're protecting the stocks into the future as well. It's the overfishing that's killing the system.
Yeah, and are things banned already? I mean, like, we have bans on...
Yeah, there would be... there's quotas for all fish, which is good, but the Irish government, back when we joined the European Union, they gave away most of our fishing rights to the Spanish and the French.
Not the Japanese?
Not the Japanese, no, because they really have no right in our waters. It's a problem because the fishing is limited for Irish fishermen, and we're paying a premium price for fish that should be much cheaper.
Let's go back to, I mean, this is interesting. It's not making people's mouths water. Let's go back and run us through some of the items on your menu. Now, you said you do have a menu for early bird specials.
Yeah, we've been doing this for the last 20 years. This is a menu that's priced very reasonable. And the idea is that you can come in early in the evening and partake of quite a few dishes off the a la carte menu and quite a few individual dishes to give you an evening meal early in the evening at a good price. It's based on €24.50 for two courses and slightly more for three courses.
That's euros.
But you can have, for instance, a tree fish mixed grill with salmon, haddock and cod. Or you can have a pot of steamy mussels. Or you can have our calamari deep fried. We do our famous fish pie with six different kinds of fish.
Wow.
And grilled sole, baked crab, the local baked crabs. So there's a lot of stuff on that you can have and enjoy, which are on the other menus as well.
So tell us, let's pick some favorite dishes off of your regular daily a la carte menu.
Okay, we'll take the main courses. The two dishes that have been on the menu for 34 years, I can't take them off because they'd kill me. One is called Bradon Delganish, which is Irish for salmon cooked Dorky style.
What is that?
This would be a fillet of salmon, which is opened up like a pouch.
Right, okay.
Stuffed with crab meat.
Wow.
Seasoned with white wine and sea salt and steamed. And then we make a sauce from the resulting liquor that comes from that. It's a white wine sauce. And that's it. That's the dish. Simple, easily cooked, very popular.
It'll be great with boiled potatoes, which is my favorite thing.
And a side salad, say. The other one
you're talking my language with this.
Okay, good to hear that. Yeah. Good to hear that. The other one that's very popular would be our fillets of sole done in our guinea pig style, which would be fillets of black sole, Dover sole, which would be steamed again in white wine and sea salt and finished with Dublin Bay prawns, mushrooms sautéed, white wine added, some of the fish liquor and some cream, and then poured over the fish when it's being served. There are two dishes that are really very popular. We have a haddock dish, we have a cod dish. We do a lovely dish with prawns and scallops in coriander sauce.
That sounds good.
With a cheese topping. That's also very, very popular, surrounded with mashed potato.
I mean, there's so many choices. What
and
do
of course
people
the,
do?
Sorry, the lobster, again, it's a big seller because we do lobster plain, grilled with lemon, with garlic. We do it the old traditional, authentic Thermidor, and we do it also Provençal. So the lobster, again, is a big dish here.
But, I mean, that's your French background. Irish food, it's not fried then, everything?
Absolutely not. No. You don't see much fried stuff. You'll see fish and chips on menus like we have here.
Yeah.
But no, grilled fish. The problem in Ireland over the years was that inside of the cities of the coastal areas, there was no fresh fish available except salmon in the rivers. And of course you could be sent to Australia for catching a salmon in the rivers in those days. But because of the ban by the Catholic Church on eating meat on Fridays,
Right. Fish
was regarded as something you had to eat. But in the country there was no fresh fish. It was all either dried fish or smoked fish. But when the ban was taken away, and then with modern technology and the movement of fish in and out all over the country within 24 hours, fish has now become a huge health thing as well as a popular fish, something to eat when you're out, rather than eating beef or lamb or chicken or duck.
Well, let's talk about who comes here, because you have a riotous list of people.
Well,
it's a celebrity gastropub, right?
Well, I wouldn't call it a gastropub.
What would you call it?
If you go back to the 1950s, again after the Second World War, Ardmore Studios in Dublin were the biggest studios in Europe. It was the only one operating after the Second World War.
They're music studios.
No, film studios.
Film studios,
okay.
Right.
And people like John Wayne, Maureen O'Hara, Peter Ustinov, all the famous names of that time were making films. The Quiet Man would have been, let's say, one of the most famous ones.
Oh, sure.
And the studios are still going strong, and they make films there all the time. But from those days, the John Wayne, Maureen O'Hara days, you move into the modern days, people like Meryl Streep, Bono,
this is his favorite.
This is one of his favorite restaurants. He wouldn't be the total favorite. It's one of his favorite places. He lives in the village. I'm trying to get the names in my head here of the different restaurants.
Yeah, well, I mean,
of the different people. Liam Neeson was one of them as well. Mel Gibson would be a regular here when he's filming. But they all come here when they're filming. Brosnan would be one of them as well.
Right,
and also for Cliff Richards, those kind of people, the singers and the musicians and the writers of the day. It's just a place they've been coming to for years, and they just keep coming.
And you said something interesting, is the Irish don't flock after celebrities, so that they probably have a lot of room to just have a quiet meal here, right?
Yeah, there's a very healthy respect for their privacy and a total disrespect for who they are. That's the Irish.
That's very clever.
One of the famous expressions in Dalkey would be, he's a legend in his own mind. Or another expression would be, I knew him when he had no arse in his trousers. These kind of expressions. So if you try to get above yourself in this little village, they'll bring you back down to earth very quick.
Which is
great.
Is the village like still ongoing locals for the most part?
Absolutely. But we do have a lot of famous people live. I mean, apart from Bono, you've got Enya lives here, Van Morrison lives here.
Really?
There's quite a few famous. And then there's a big splattering of people who keep themselves very quiet.
But there must be some big houses. You're right on the coast.
Yeah, well,
so
what happened? The houses are amazing, because what happened in Dublin City back in the 18th century, there was always TB, there was unhealthy air, there was always just unhealthy living.
Yeah,
and
so
the wealthy people moved out of the city. They bought their land in the Dalkey area, built their houses on the cliffs and out overlooking the sea. And those houses now would be lived in by fifth, sixth generations of people. But obviously the people who built them originally are long gone. but they're now being beautifully rejuvenated and rebuilt again and lived in by wealthy people.
It sounds like a good location for a restaurant.
Yeah, it would be. Yeah, but the private houses can't be converted into a restaurant. But the village itself.
No, I meant for a good location for your restaurant.
Of course.
Of course, you've been here longer than that.
But there again, we don't rely on the famous people so much as the regular clientele.
Brings us to how do people come to eat here? We already did the hours. What about your website?
It's www.guineapig.dalkey.info.
Okay.
And on that you'll get all the menus, you get a virtual tour of the restaurant, the history of the restaurant, and a little bit of my own history, which would include when I was King of Dalkey.
Oh, tell us about that.
King of Dalkey, well, that is a tradition in Dalkey going back to the 1850s, where they had elected a king every year. It was started off by a group of anti-royalists in Trinity College in the 1750s. And they proclaimed a King of Dalkey every year on the island across from the coast called Dalkey Island. In 1797, the last old king was a pawnbroker called King Stephen the First, and 12,000 people attended his crowning.
It's amazing.
And the British government banned all meetings more than 12 people at a crossroads or a church or chapel, because they're expecting a rebellion in 1798, which actually happened in 1798. So it was brought back again after the Second World War, and I was fortunate to be elected His Royal Highness King Mervyn I, King of Dalkey, in 1986.
And did you get royal robes and a crown?
Oh, we have a beautiful crown, the royal ermine robes, the whole works. I had my own navy, my own army, my own pages and maids of honour. The whole thing was beautifully done out. But it's all on the website to look at. It's officially a town, but we call it the town with the village mentality or the village atmosphere.
There you go. I mean, we just drove through it, and it has an enormous amount of charm. And we read that there's a town that perhaps once upon a time was similar called Bray, which is just down the coast, which has been totally spoiled by development and cheap tourism.
Absolutely.
This is just so convenient.
I think we're fortunate that it's nestled between a hill and a town.
Right.
But the harbour in Dalkey was the original harbour for Dublin, because there was a sandbar at the mouth of the Liffey, which fed out of Dublin city. And what would happen was boats would shelter between the island and the coast. Small shell boats would carry the goods from the ships into what was known as Collymore Harbour, then by pack animal to the seven castles in the village, and then pack animal to the Liberties, which was the city centre. Now, back in the days of the famous Mutiny on the Bounty guy,
Captain Bligh,
he was an engineer. He was a genuine guy. He was an engineer with the Royal Navy, and his job was to travel the world to find safe, deep harbours with fresh water and timber for the ships. And he got the job of sounding out the bay to see what he could do to get rid of the sand that was in the mouth of the Liffey. And he built these two massive arms called the North Bull and the South Bull. And within 12 years, the silting up had been dragged out and distributed behind these two big arms.
Wow.
And the Liffey became navigable at that stage.
Amazing.
And then Dalkey became into decline, but the castles are all still there.
Okay, I think our guidebook said there were actually seven altogether.
Seven, yes.
And we only saw two. Are there more than two left?
They're around, yeah. There's someone on the coast. There's two on the main street. Some of them are gone at this stage. Sorry, some of them are gone, but it had seven castles.
But what's left behind is an island of charm that's within 20 minutes of the Dublin International Airport.
Well, with the modern motorway today, it's about 25 minutes to the airport, yeah.
Absolutely amazing, and I think we wish we'd come here earlier to try to explore, but I'll bet one of the problems that exists is parking on the streets.
It can be a problem, but there are car parks in the area.
Yeah, we found one.
But the big one is the DART. The rapid transport leaves you right outside my restaurant.
Okay,
very
right.
Close to the centre of the village.
In fact, we're parked right in front of that railway station right now.
And a lot of people now come from quite a distance away, but they come early in the evening on the DART, have their dinner, go back on the DART. No problem with driving and drinking.
Well, this is very good. And I can hardly wait to taste your food. And you have a lot of history here, but you also are really up to date in all the technology and marketing and everything. I think I'm so pleased to have met you, Mervyn.
Thank you. Well, one of the things, I'm 67 now, and the internet was something I didn't embrace until about 5 years ago. And now I can't do without it, because it's an amazing opening into the world of food and trends. But one of the things that I've discovered here is that you don't change your style. You don't, people say it's very old fashioned. Good. That's the style we're operating under. It's not modern. It's not nouvelle. It's old fashioned. And the food is a reflection of what my customers over the last 30 years have looked for. We don't go, we do change menus a little bit. We do put on some new dishes and new innovations. But we do know that if I took off the duck off the menu, or I took off the sole and the bone, or changed the dish for the pasta, there would be a riot, because people say, I came for that dish. Where is it?
Right.
There's a great story that happened last Christmas. We do a dessert display. And last Christmas, we took off the bread and butter pudding with custard to make room for the Christmas pudding. And there was a gentleman in the restaurant, and he was looking very unhappy. And I said to his wife, what's wrong with him tonight? And she said, there's no bread and butter pudding on the tray tonight. I said, sorry about that. We took it off for Christmas. But look, the good news is it's back on next week. And she said, thank God for that. So that will tell you, people like comfort food. Yeah. They like the comfort zone. They like the repeatability of the menu, and they can. Some people come back with the same thing all the time.
Well, we're gonna have fun when we choose to edit this interview into a program, because we're gonna have to choose between King Mervyn the First and King Citric, which is a restaurant we're going to about 3 days from now, which is just across the other side of the Dublin Harbour. And I bet you know the owner of that place.
That's my good friend Aidan, and I've known Aidan for over nearly 50 years.
So
he's a great chef.
So whichever one comes first, if King Citric comes second, we'll have to have him explain how he got the name in the same way that you did.
Well, the King Citric has a great history. The King Citric is a Norse name.
Oh, okay. Well,
on the far side of the city.
Well, let's
yeah. Well, let him explain.
Well, he was never the king of Holmes.
Oh. Well, this is going to be a delightful evening, and I'm really looking forward to
it. Well, I hope we covered a few bases there.
I think so, and they can certainly pick up more.
Can I just mention one thing more here?
Of course.
2 years ago, when the recession got deep here in Ireland, we were looking for a way of marketing the restaurant with a new menu. And we came up with an idea of €80 per couple for a big 5-course dinner, including a bottle of wine.
For €80.
And we were trying to put wording on that. We were trying to put the wording on that. And my wife said, well, why don't we put something we can celebrate? And I said, okay, we're 52 years of business. Why not celebrate 52 years of business? So we put this menu up, and we called it our celebration menu. Come and join us to celebrate with us 52 years of business. And it worked like a dream.
Really?
Because people love this word, celebration, opposed to recession. So we booked the trend. We went the opposite direction and said, and people say to me, cocky bastard, celebrating in the middle of a recession. But it works. So that's part of the marketing strategy, to get away from the race to the bottom, recession menus, all that sort of thing. We just don't get involved in that. And people are delighted that they don't come into a restaurant that's talking about recession on the menu or by price or whatever. People actually enjoy getting away from all of that.
Well, I mean, I think your restaurant is, I'm sure the food is just wonderful, and we'll find out about that shortly. But I'm sure a lot of the success has to do with your personality, absolutely exuberant.
Well, it's important. I mean, I say hello to every customer every night. I go around the table, say hi, how are you getting on, join your evening. And it's part of what I've always done, part of what I enjoy. It's part of what I am. It's part of my life. And people do appreciate that, because not many chefs will go to the tables. I think they tend to stay in the kitchen. But I just love, it's an escape from me from the kitchen for a few minutes anyway.
Very good.
But I would know a lot of my customers over the years, and they would be delighted to say hi. And it's something I've always done, and something I always will do.
Well, let's hope you get a lot of new customers from listening to this program. We'll be trotting over here to try out your wonderful restaurant. Mervyn, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Anne wants me to note here that I think she misheard Mervyn when he introduced himself. So she was nothing if not consistent, and unfortunately in slightly mispronouncing his name. Mervyn, I hope you'll forgive us for that. And I'm sure you will, because we had a wonderful time. And one of the great things is that we noticed that your daughter, of course, was waiting on us in the restaurant. And it seems like when you finally hang it up, which I'm sure won't be anytime soon, the restaurant will continue. The guinea pig will probably go on forever. And more power to it.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, welcome back, and I guess you're going to set up this next one.
Well, the interesting thing, and it is a pure coincidence, because we placed all the places, we put them in alphabetical order. And even though we're in alphabetical order, it turns out that K is the last letter in our current Irish alphabet, King Citric. And King Citric and Mervyn Stewart's guinea pig have two things in common. First of all, they know one another extremely well. They're great friends. They both have a great love of food and wine, and especially of seafood. So Ireland has great seafood, but not a long tradition of cooking seafood in fine restaurants, we understand. I think Aidan McManus in this interview actually says that when he started the restaurant, it was all meat on the menu because he thought that his customers couldn't possibly be interested in eating fish. But it turned out they were, and that
especially lobster. Ooh.
Especially lobster. Yeah, we had wonderful lobster.
Yeah,
we had wonderful seafood all around. So here's Aidan and Joan McManus of King Citric, just outside the city of Dublin, and only 20 minutes from the airport.
Well, I've been in Howth, a suburb of Dublin, for less than an hour, I believe. I've already learned a whole bunch of things. That's from talking to Aidan and Joan McManus, who are proprietors of not only outstanding but well-recognized restaurant and accommodation called King Citric. Now, I guess we should start with the obvious. Welcome to you, or you're welcoming us.
Absolutely, Anne. Welcome to you both, to Howth and the King Citric. We're delighted to see you here.
And now tell us, just start off with, who is King Citric?
You might know that Dublin was quite a big Viking city, and Citric was a Viking, hence the helmet. And now I know there weren't too many helmets found in the ruins, but anyway, it's part of the logo here, and it is recognised. There was a Viking landing in Howth, and it's said that Citric founded the first church in Howth. So when Aidan's late father was, when we were all setting up the restaurant here, he was doing some research to get a theme going in the restaurant that would be based on the locality.
Tell us about that.
My father was a journalist in the independent group of newspapers here in Dublin, and he was a good historian, and particularly for the local area. I was born and lived in Clontarf with my parents, who had been there for 40 years or so. And when we bought this premises in 1970, he was looking for a name, and he decided that the King Citric would be the name. He was the first of the Viking kings to become a Christian, and had built a church on this area, just on the hill behind us here.
You missed something. He decided to open business?
It was my mother, really, as against my father. She was the driving force. I was a young chef, had left school quite early and was working abroad, and my mother was quite anxious that I might come home. And as they used to come out, Catholics as they were, every Thursday or Friday morning they'd come out to Howth to buy the fish, and she saw this rather dilapidated looking house, I have to say, at the time.
We saw pictures of.
So they asked me to come home and have a look at the premises to see if I would be willing to work it or own it or get involved in it. And of course, I thought all my dreams had come true. I didn't know what a life sentence it was going to be. But we bought the house in 1970 thinking that we would be open sort of by Christmas, and it actually was August the following year before we actually got open. There was lots of trials and tribulations at the time. Planning permission, wayward builders, money, all sorts of little things that would put things back another month or a day or a week or whatever. But since then, it's been quite a success.
And now, where does Joan come in? How did you get
Well, you know, we're celebrating 40 years this year. And I have to say, in all modesty, most people say, but you couldn't be here 40 years. And I say, well, no, I haven't that long. But I joined Aidan in Business. We met sailing here, actually, on a fun event. And I joined Aidan in Business in 1980. So I have been here since then. And we've worked together in the business.
Now, describe the kind of accommodation you have. From our room, we have a glorious view of the sea and the harbour.
Yeah. Well, we see ourselves as a restaurant with rooms. And I know you've been to Italy and to France a lot, Anne. So you know that whole idea. Now, we're called a guest house. I think in the States, people might know it as an inn. And we're very much, we come from the restaurant side. So food is very important. We're very lucky here in Howth. We have a beautiful location. We're here in a picturesque, traditional fishing village in the suburbs of Dublin, only 25 minutes by Dart. I have to say, all of our visitors here, they can't believe, they think they're out in the country or in the west of Ireland.
Oh, absolutely true. Yes, yeah. It's so peaceful.
And you notice now, you're up in the Rockabill room. We called all the rooms after lighthouses. Because we just thought, we're so close to the sea here, you're lying in bed, really, short of being in a lighthouse, you couldn't be much closer.
Uh-huh.
But it's really, Howth is a spot removed from the hustle of the city, and yet so close. Very lucky.
Your specialty is, of course, seafood, which from your location, I imagine, is pretty pristine. But you really started out working with seafood if you're from this area, so you were really born to...
Well, yes and no. When we started the restaurant, as I said, in 1971, my first menu would have had six meat dishes, I say main courses.
Because of the times, your customers...
Because of the times, I was afraid. Whereas I had been working with seafood and enjoyed it, didn't think that Irish people. My parents told me they wouldn't eat it. My friends told me they wouldn't eat it.
That's so bizarre because it's so readily acceptable.
It was an Irish thing in a sense. And in many ways it probably is still there with a lot of people. But within 6 to 8 months the menu changed because the product I was able to get on the pier, lots of it nearly free because the fishermen didn't even know what they were catching.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Peter has stories about that in England that they would throw away fish that he would then collect. Yeah.
It's like monkfish because it was so ugly.
It really is ugly.
Nobody could have two ways. And nobody could think, they just weren't accustomed to using it. Nobody could think what to do with it.
Yeah, it's like when I cooked Peter a surprise dinner of crab meat stuffed grouper heads. We only had those once.
Adventurous.
Right, it was a secret to the last minute. Working from the menu, well, we don't have a menu, but you know the menu. Run us through some of the offerings you have. I was surprised you had oysters.
Oh, no. Oysters are part of the seafood chain. Okay, they're not indigenous to the east coast of Ireland, but from the west coast. Bearing in mind that it's only a 2-hour drive basically now from here to Galway. We would use a lot of oysters during the season. The unfortunate thing is that our native oyster is really only available from September to May and September to April even. And that is in the non-tourist time of the year. Whereas,
it's a
pity that a lot of was there. But now that we've been able to cheat nature in the nicest possible way with the rock oyster, we have the rock oyster.
Now, what is a rock oyster? It's not...
Well, it's the Portuguese varietal of oyster.
You import it?
No.
You grow it?
We don't grow it, but they are now utilized in Ireland. I don't know if you know the story of the sex life of an oyster. Oyster changes its sex within the temple.
A lot of animals do that. I mean, I would time it so that I would change sex when I wouldn't have to be pregnant. Let him be pregnant.
Well, they have discovered that it's the temperature of the water. When the water temperature rises, and it only takes a degree and a half, and then they go into sex change, and then they start breeding. So that's why you can't have them during the months, basically, without the oar. But for the Portuguese variety of oyster, we are more used to warmer waters. So our waters in the Northern Hemisphere are that much colder, so therefore they don't get a chance to change sex, and therefore they stay available all the year round.
Is that why mussels, Mediterranean mussels, are really fat and wonderful off-season when our other mussels aren't any good?
Ask me another.
No. I just thought of it. I've fallen totally madly in love with Irish lobsters. Just absolutely the most incredible lobster I've ever had.
You're in the right place for lobster here.
Yeah. Do you get it from the West Coast?
No. From outside the window.
Really?
You're looking at our lobster men in the morning or in the evening, and you'll see them all out there. They're only small little boats. They're only day fishers. Most of them that go for the pots. And are here, literally, in the bay. We have the lobster, the crab,
shrimp,
and whelks. We don't normally use the whelks, but they catch quite a few.
Oh, I've had whelks, yeah.
Well, we have really...
It's tedious. They're tedious to eat.
Yeah.
We haven't quite thought of something to do with whelks that would appeal to Irish people.
Well, okay, so that brings us to another whole thing. So we've got the seafood. What is your approach, just so people coming to eat here understand your style of cooking? You've got this wonderful product. What do you do with it?
For me, is as little as possible. I try to serve it as its best in form without messing it up. I'm not in favor with the chemist coming in and turning it into something that is totally different to what it is. Like, I mean, we get a lobster here, you can buy you can have a grilled lobster or a steamed lobster. It's served in the shell. Okay, we do crack the claws and various sort of things to make it as easy as possible. We also have two or three dishes where we take flesh out of it and put it into sauces and put it back sort of on the shell for presentation. But it would be the same with turbot and with brill, with sole.
Yeah, so you do really fresh fin fish, because the brill looked wonderful on the menu.
Yeah, brill, turbot, black sole are all very popular fishes, but they are quite expensive. And now during the recession that we're
they are very expensive.
Prime fish. Whereas
more expensive than your shellfish?
Yes. At this time of the year, shellfish is quite reasonable. They call them now the bottom feeders, haven't been seriously hit by overstocking or by overfishing. And we've had a stock enhancement plan for several years now in this area where we don't take the berries and we V-notch the tails, and they have to be a certain size before you can take them out. And that has worked wonders over the years. Crab, I don't know how it survives, but it seems to be thriving all the time. Shrimp. Well, we get the shrimp it's a short season, and it's a minority product that we get from the pots here. But the other fish is all subject to overfishing.
A hard time dealing with that.
Yeah.
There's now an app for your smartphone that tells you the latest on what you're not allowed to order because it's overfished. I mean, it just goes on and on.
Some of these things give out false information. They give it out for a locality, and people accept that, and therefore they think that it's not available anywhere. But, I mean, we have such a large coastline in Ireland, and really, when it all said and done, a very small fishing fleet. So a lot of our quotas and a lot of our areas don't get to this. So we have still a reasonable amount of sustainable fish within our own waters. Whereas when we go a little bit further out, beyond the 12 miles, the coastal, I suppose I will say it, has been raped by the European fishing fleet. And right. The Japanese fishing fleet occasionally
don't even talk
as well.
About that. I mean, they don't even show up at the conferences on overfishing.
Yeah.
But like poor tuna. So menus, I think we have an idea about. What about, we're drinking this fabulous wine, tell us about that and about your 40th anniversary.
As you can see, we're now in our little wine cellar.
It's wonderful, yes.
And wine has always been a sort of a passion of mine, and Joan has joined into it in a big way. And, many years ago, we were using Muscadet as our house wine, which was a sort of a cheap, cheerful wine to use with seafood. And we ran into a few problems with our supplier. And I had a tasting with a few friends of about 25 different wines, and we broke it all down to eventually the one wine, which was the Pinot Blanc, a Cuvée des Lamours from Hugel in Rickfair in Alsace. And it was at that time, this was sort of in the early 80s, it was the big fashion. You could get your own label. God knows what the wine was, but if you had your own label,
right,
you were great. But so we asked this Mr. Hugel to please give us our own label. He said, no, we do not do other labels. We do the yellow label on our bottle, and that is that. So I said, okay, well, we'll still take it anyway. And subsequently, he has labeled the label for us over the years. He's put our own logo on it and so on. And for our 40th anniversary this year, from the 18th of August, they've been able to put a little bi-label on it with our logo, the Citric helmet, and the 40 years.
And it's beautiful wine.
It's an excellent wine. It has remained very consistent. There's slight changes every vintage, but it is generally very, very consistent and extremely good with a variety of fish, which is what we specialize in. Spent a long time over the years building up a relationship with the Hugels. I have done a stage in the Auberge de Lille, which is a Michelin 3-star restaurant just beside them there in a village called Illhausen. And I stayed with the Hugel family. They've stayed with us here since we've got the rooms, but we used to meet them. Johnny used to come over here every so often he loved a bit of fishing and travelling on the Shannon River and the river cruises. So with himself and his wife, we've had a very, very good relationship. Unfortunately, Johnny died 2 years ago.
Oh, no.
And I was over for the funeral, a very sad occasion. But he had a great life. He was a great ambassador for Alsatian wine. He travelled the world, not just selling his wine, but Alsatian wines, which was a great passion for him.
And do you remember, Aidan, he was responsible for setting up the Vendage Tardive. He forced them to think new classifications for Alsace wine.
Oh, okay.
So he was greatly respected over that because he, I think, wasn't his 1976 the first Vendage Tardive, his Gewürztraminer 76, and he forced them into reclassifying some sections of Alsace wine that hadn't been dealt with before in these sweet and these late harvest wines. Uh-huh. He was really a great man. But, you know, the king dies, long live the king.
Right.
His nephew is in charge now, and still a wonderful company. It's over 350 years old, and business goes on, but they all miss him, and we miss him enormously. And we're going over there, actually, in about 2 weeks' time, a few of us, and we will visit Hugel and see how they're getting on, and we're really looking forward to that.
Now, we haven't really homed in yet on staying here experience. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us a little bit about the accommodation?
Well, we only have the bedrooms here for 10 years. And our brief to the builders when we were doing this was maximize the environment. We wanted the internal to be natural, natural fabrics, natural materials. And you're looking outside here. In our old building, it was a very classical Georgian house. Now, very fine architecture, we'd be the first to say. Before central heating and before triple glazing and everything, you had to hide from the elements. Now, in our new building here, we wanted to have everybody looking out to the elements. So we have very good windows. We made them as large as we were allowed to with the planning. You're looking out at the sea. At this time of year, everybody has the windows open. They're listening to the sea, the waves, the birds in the morning, and the whole area is extremely quiet here.
So, it's beautiful.
Yeah, it really is. And it's, as I said earlier, really people are astonished that you can have such peace and such beautiful environment so close to the city. When people are here in Howth, they do very natural things. Like when people say, where's the shopping? Well, I said, well, now this isn't really the area for shopping.
Go to
you
Dublin,
have to go downtown for that. What we do here in Howth is we just enjoy the environment. We walk the piers.
Which
we
is what we're going to do.
You're going to do that now. We look at the fish shops.
Now we're going to look in fish shops, and you're going to introduce us to some suppliers.
We have some, absolutely, and Aidan will take you down now to one of our favourite shops where our smoked salmon comes from. And this, we have some wonderful connections on the pier, but for people who aren't so foodie and who like a bit of fresh air, we have some looped walks here. You can walk the hill from about an hour and a half walk here to say 4 hours. And we can provide other walks for you as well. This is a great golfing area. If you have a boat, you do need the connection. It's a great sailing area. There's quite a lot of fresh air and exercise out here. If people want to do nothing, it's a great place to do nothing as well. You can just relax.
Now, our American listeners will be familiar with that great philosopher, Yogi Berra. who was actually a catcher and a manager in the world of baseball, and a very successful one. But he was also a great philosopher, and so he made statements like, when you get to a fork in the road, take it, and nobody goes there anymore because it's too crowded. And it was like deja vu all over again. But if I can coin a yogiism about Hoth, it's called, when you get to the end of the road, you're at the end of the road and King Citric is right there.
That's it.
And the website is kingsitric.ie. King Citric available via a variety of other different routes as well, I think, on the internet.
Blue Book.
And Ireland's Blue Book, of course, who helped us with our stay and arranged for us to be here today. We thank them. But most of all, we thank Aidan and Joan for sharing their 40th anniversary wine, part of their 40th anniversary year. And we're just delighted to be here. And now we've got to go about the rest of our business.
Thank you, Peter and Dan. And we'd love to see anyone who's coming our way. We'd love to welcome them here.
And, you know, I wanted to make sure I mentioned that we got a nice little tour of the harbor and saw, like, where the shrimp boats come in and so forth. And I mean, some of the suppliers were closed because it was getting late. But we did get to Nikki's place, which does all the smoked fish for the King Citric.
And lots of other places, too.
And lots of other places, too. And if you want to see us all enjoying the little lesson in fish smoking, go to OTM.
In pictures
on our website.
Yep, there's a picture of Anne there. Of course, Peter's, as usual, is behind the camera, and the crew is out front.
But you got to eat most of the smoked fish salmon that we brought back.
I did.
Okay, yes. So now that was time.
That's only because you were eating something else at the same time.
Okay.
It doesn't keep. It actually does keep, but it was too good not to eat it right away, and we really did enjoy it. And Nikki, if you're listening, we certainly thank you. And Aidan, if you're listening too, we thank you, because we didn't have time to thank you properly, because we were up and off for the airport at 6 o'clock in the next morning, while everybody in the whole town of Hoth. We're still fast asleep. We did catch our plane. We did get home. We were sad when we did. And all we could think of was heading back to the Emerald Isle again, which I'm sure we'll do very soon. So we'll look forward to seeing you and some of your friends in the not-too-distant future. And we're not done yet. We'll be back with a slight change of subject right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, we have a slight shift, of course. We're now going to turn to a new cookbook by one of our favorite authors.
It's not an entirely radical shift.
No, it sort of fits the general mood of...
Not only that, the author of Odd Bits and Bones and Fat is Australian by nationality, but by surname McLagan. Sure sounds Irish to me. So we're continuing an Irish theme, but with a really fun subject called The Odd Bits.
Here is a woman who does not shrink from rather controversial subjects. Jennifer McLagan, we interviewed you about your book, Bones, Fat, and now you have one called Odd Bits, How to Cook the Rest of the Animal. And you unflinchingly present all the odd bits.
Yes, I do. I call it my carnivorous trilogy.
Right. First of all, the photographs. I think they're right in your face, and you don't tiptoe around anything.
No, I really don't think there's any point tiptoeing around. If you're going to talk about these pieces, I want to kind of point out to people that really they're not that odd. They've only become odd maybe last 20 or 30 years when we seem to buy our meat in a supermarket that's all shrink-wrapped instead of at a butcher, and we don't see whole animals or half animals hanging up. So I wanted to put it in your face. I don't think we should be shocked by seeing a pig's head or the pig's feet. I'm not, and if you are shocked, it's just because you're not familiar with them. So I'm trying to make people more familiar with them as well.
And I didn't realize, but not that didn't focus on the fact that I really was raised on a lot of this stuff. But what happened is, with the loss of the independent butcher shops, it's hard getting it.
No, that's the problem, because now that supermarkets have taken over, I'm old enough, I guess they came later in Australia, that's what I like to say, but I'm old enough to remember before a supermarket, we would always buy our meat at the butcher. We would always shop that way, you know. And these are kind of cuts that don't appear in supermarkets because a lot of them are very fragile and they're hard to keep for any length of time. They need to be very, very fresh when you buy them. And those people aren't getting in whole animals. They're just getting in steaks and sirloins and chops. And nobody's writing any recipes for them, so no one's cooking them or asking for them to supply them. So I'm hoping that I can help stem the tide and maybe turn the tide around in the other direction.
Well, there is a trend, as you know, and you mentioned it in your book. There is a trend towards people relearning butchery.
Yes.
And also this nose-to-tail cooking, which Fergus Henderson started out from London promoting. And I've been in at events where the butchery classes cost like $125 for 2 hours, and they sell out.
I think that's great. I think there is an interest, because there's been the interest in food has really changed in the last few years. People really want to know where their food's coming from, how it's been raised. And the next step, I guess, a lot of people buy whole or half animals from farmers, and they want to know how to butcher it themselves or where the cuts come from, even if they're not going to end up doing that butchery. And I think that's fabulous. And I think there's also a trend where there's more and more smaller butcher's stores being opened by young people, right? And I think that is just the best trend ever.
Yes, I do too. I wish we had one opening here. Now, when we first moved here, we had our own butcher, and he just went out of business at some point, and I never could replace him. Then I had farmer suppliers. We have two really very excellent organic lamb growers in the area, but I used to buy the whole lamb, and nobody else wanted the odd bits, and I used to get all of the livers and kidneys and all that until he opened his own processing plant, in which case it's now called Florkill, is it? Something like that, and it costs more to process it by the USDA, and he can't sell it.
Uh-huh.
You touch on that in your book as well.
Well, it's a problem, you know, a problem of, like, slaughterhouses disappearing, of, like, them putting them all into one spot and then having to ship the animals long distances, which is not a good thing either. It's stressing the animals. They, you know, if you put it all into one place, it's going to be more economic. But I really don't think it's better for it. So I guess all you can do is just try and beg or demand or ask for these pieces of the animal. And if there's enough demand, then maybe at the slaughterhouses they'll actually take the time to take these bits out of the animal. Like you see in Europe where there's a demand, it's quite easy to buy these pieces.
Yeah, but it's really not easy in the States, I can assure you. Although my hope is that since it has become kind of trendy, that there will be more and more shops opening.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, I'm hoping my book will be a step in that direction, because I think you can start a trend, right? By giving people the information, by giving them the recipes, it would be great if there was a national food magazine that did a spread on cooking. Maybe not something very weird, but something that's not that strange, like liver and kidney. And these are very fast foods to cook, and everyone's talking about being time-strapped. I just think it's just a waste that we're not cooking this way.
So aside from livers and kidneys, which we're, of course, quite familiar with, and tongues, which we can get very occasionally, are there any other cuts that you think are kind of mainstream odd bits?
Well, I do have some not-so-odd bits in there. Like, I have recipes for shank and belly, because what I want to show to people is, like, pork belly was kind of an odd bit for a lot of people. They thought, you know, maybe it was bacon, and it was only in a Chinese restaurant you'd be eating pork belly. But it seems to have made that leap into the mainstream restaurants. And where I am, you can hardly go to any restaurant and there isn't pork belly on the menu.
Exactly.
It's a matter of, like, bringing them out. But I try and get people to try things like tongue. I think that's easier to get, and it's such a fabulous piece of meat. And my other one that I love to promote is heart, because that was my big discovery working on this book.
Heart, yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, I tried beef heart once, and it was so tough. I mean, it was...
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Because every time I've had beef heart, it's been really tender. It, like, not soft and melting, but it's a dense meat. But I cook it very rare, and it's fabulous. But I tell people just to grind some up or get the butcher to grind it and add it to their burger mix and just try it in a burger. It's fabulous when it's ground up.
Yeah, now, you did something. I mean, people who are squeamish about a lot of these odd bits, they don't even know they're eating them when they're eating them in sausages.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of places where they eat them and they have no idea that they're in there, right? So maybe if you are squeamish, maybe you put them into you put the liver into meatloaf, or you put the heart into your favorite meatloaf or hamburger recipe. That's a way to reintroduce it into your diet.
You know, there are a few things I've never had. I told you before of having a lot of these things growing up, like tripe, which to me is texture. It's the sauce that makes the difference.
You're exactly right.
I've never had lungs. What distinguishes lungs?
I don't know that they're that distinguishable really in lots of ways. It was funny, I was talking to Fergus Henderson, and he said that's the only thing he doesn't really like to eat. But I found them more like, once they were cooked and sliced up in the soup, which was a fabulous, the soup was fabulous, but I'm sure you could make it without lungs. They had a texture similar to tongue. It's not something that I would search out, but it was a similar texture. But the soup was really quite delicious.
Yeah, I'm just looking at that recipe, actually. But you have two. You have sour lung soup, too, which sounds really unattractive.
But it has this wonderful garnish of, like, capers and onions and garlic, you know, that kind of flavors in at the end. So it's really, really quite delicious. And I got it from this wonderful German chef in Berchtesgaden who is very sweet. And he sent me a picture of him and his girlfriend. And then he sent me the recipe. And then he sent me step-by-step photos of the recipe. Like, how many chefs do that for you, right?
Oh, right.
So I had to put it in the book.
Now, Anne made a discovery about head cheese. that it's not really a cheese, but it's the right explanation.
Yes, because they make it in a form, and that's the same form they used to make cheese in. So that's why it got the name of head cheese in France, and we seem to have picked up the French term for it rather than the German's Presskopf, which is pressed head.
And, yeah.
And that's why we call it the head cheese, which is such kind of a silly name in a way. But
it is kind of strange, and it's not something that a lot of Americans would sign up for, I don't think, even though it's actually really delicious.
You're right, it's fabulous. You know, I just say, cook the pig's head and chop up all the bits of meat and skin and pack it into a bowl or a loaf mold, and you don't even have to put the jelly in. There's such enough gelatin and collagen in that. You'll make kind of this molded meat loaf. It'll stick to itself. Cut it into slices and then fry it in a really hot pan just till it's starting to melt, and then serve that on a toast or with eggs for breakfast. And it's just a fabulous collection of cooked meat.
Now, I have a lot of trouble with sweetbreads. Peter adores sweetbreads, and when I cook them, they end up like rocks. What am I doing wrong?
I think you're cooking them too long. They really just need to be poached really gently until they're just, there's a great expression there, you know, the resistance of a woman's breast, but they just need to have a little bit of resistance, and then I like to press them, which gives them a bit more resistance, and really, then when you cook them, they should have this kind of smooth, creamy texture. They're denser than brains, but they should have a fabulous, creamy texture. They shouldn't be tough at all.
That's the simile that you just used reminds me of a friend of mine telling me about how to tell when the fruit is ripe. You just touch it and it should have the feel of testicles.
Well,
what is it?
If you use
persimmon,
there's some testicle recipes in there.
Yeah.
A lot of experience.
Yeah, I mean, you need a lot of rabbits to get a meal out of testicles. So, listen, we haven't talked about, I thought your organization of your book was interesting. Talk about that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I thought, for me, it was absolutely the only way to go, to start, you know, because nose-to-tail eating, as we said, is to start at the nose and go right the way through to the tail. And then someone said to me, well, you can't start with head cheese because you'll put everybody off. And I said, well, probably the cover and then the inside spread of the pig's head in a pot. If I haven't put them off by then, I'm sure they can handle head cheese, right? It's just more interesting to do it that way. You know, it's not the kind of book that you can do main courses, appetizers, because maybe a lot of these things should always be appetizers because people are trying them for the first time, so they can just have a little taste and a snack before they commit to it as a dish.
Well, as I said, I don't even find them very odd, and I'm looking forward to reading your recipes to just have, because that's, the taste is what really comes through with all these, even if it's texture,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I keep telling people that probably if you don't think you like them, it's probably just between your ears. It's not really on your palate, right? It's a little hurdle that you have to get over.
Uh-huh.
I think it's important to do that, because if you're going to kill animals, the way you can honor them is by eating all of them, not by throwing half of them away.
Exactly. Now, I must ask you, are you tackling insects next?
Well, it's funny you should ask that, actually, because I was interviewed and someone asked me, is there anything you don't eat? And I said, I pretty much try everything, but this is a textural, some textures I don't like tripe can be slippery, sea cucumbers I'm not a big fan of.
Oh, I love those. Espardenyas.
You know, it's interesting. And I said, I'm not a big fan. I mean, I've eaten insects, but I said, I don't really like them like in Australia where the Aborigines eat witchetty grubs that are
right.
still alive. You know, I said, I like my food to be dead.
Uh-huh.
And then I thought about it, and I think, well, no, I eat an oyster, you know? And that's just been opened on the half shell. It's not very dead when I go to eat it, right? So it's in my head, too. Everybody has a prejudice against some kind of food.
Well, insects are the next horizon, I think, once we get past this scraping the moss off of trees that they do.
Well, I just had a friend who came back from Mexico, and he was doing deep-fried grasshoppers.
Oh, yeah, that's fairly common.
Yeah.
Angelina Jolie fed them to her kids.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I thought that was very brave of her.
Good for her.
Yeah.
Well, you have to have a good supply of grasshoppers.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I used to see them in the Guatemalan city market, these little things that were still moving and crawling, and I just can't get past the insect thing. I've done rattlesnake. I just can't do insects.
Yeah, I've done snake too, but I've had chocolate-covered ants and things like that.
Yeah, well, I guess chocolate...
Chocolate helps, right?
Right.
Well, Jennifer,
what is your next book?
Yeah, we just can't wait to find out what you're going to tackle next.
Well, that's a good question. You know, I've done three now, and for me, they take, you know, I'm not very fast at this. It takes me a good 3 years to do each book. Kind of thinking I want a little bit of a break for a while. Got a couple of ideas rattling around, and they're not too popular, so then I know that's a good idea.
You're not going to tell us that.
No, I'm not going to tell you.
Well, I'll wait to hear from you next.
I'll let you know as soon as I decide what it is.
Yeah, well, these are prize books for me. I have all three of them, so, you know, and I know where to go when I need to figure out how I'm going to do the next tongue I get.
Oh, see, here's tongue recipes?
Yes.
See, I already have two, I mean, but it's always nice to have another one.
That's good. And, you know, one of my discoveries, too, was hot tongue. You know, I'd always had, my mother made cold jellied tongue for Christmas. And, you know, we always had cold tongue sandwiches. But at the back end of the tongue where it's, you know, it's bigger and it's a little bit more marbled with fat, if you cut yourself quarter inch slices from that and throw them on the grill so they're crispy, it's fabulous.
Oh, well, I like hot tongue, but I've never grilled them.
No, we just made them with a long braise, I guess.
Uh-huh. That's good, too, but try the cooked tongue slice.
Okay, we'll try that.
With a glaze, or a honey glaze, or even a barbecue sauce on it. It's fabulous.
So you cook it first, and then
exactly.
Okay, and then you recook the
all you're doing
pieces
is
at the back end.
It up, right?
Okay. We've liked it, and we've had it twice. I made it twice for Anne, and she liked it both times and said, why isn't there more?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So all we need to do is lay our hands on some more, and we can try your recipe, too.
Oh, good. You must let me know how it goes.
Okay.
We will do that.
Thanks, Jennifer, so much.
Thanks. It's great to talk to you again.
Keep going. I can hardly wait for the next book.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jennifer. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that's all we have it on the menu for another week, but we hope to see you same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.